and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the just-completed elections in Afghanistan that are being hailed as a success by Afghan and Western leaders. We'll look into the apparent gulf between the people's aspiration for governance and the realities of a government beset by systemic corruption, crippled by capital flight from the elite, and a countryside controlled by either the Taliban or fiefdoms run by warlords. A decades-long researcher of Afghanistan's culture and politics, Thomas Barfield, the president of the American Institute of Afghanistan Studies, professor of anthropology at Boston University and author of Afghanistan, A Cultural and Political History, joins us to discuss whether democracy is taking root in this war-torn, economically dependent country that has been the battleground for America's longest war. Then we'll get an assessment of the success of the Affordable Care Act sign-up of 7.1 million Americans that the White House is celebrating and examine its effect on the upcoming election, which so far is muted, with the Republicans who have been ritually denouncing Obamacare being curiously silent and Democrats who have been tepidly supporting it apparently ambivalent. Cheryl Kaminsky, a professor of health policy and management and director of the UCLA Center for Health Policy Research, joins us to evaluate the ACA's impact on health care reform. Then finally, Thomas Herschel, the director of the Population and Development Program at Cornell University, joins us to discuss his much-anticipated new book, just out, Chasing the American Dream, Understanding What Shapes Our Fortunes, which looks into the darker side of the land of opportunity, analyzing 41 years of data that finds a majority of Americans will experience poverty despite the American dream's promise of a good life that is attainable through hard work and perseverance. And joining us now is Thomas Barfield, who's a professor of anthropology at Boston University, where he directs the Institute for the Study of Muslim Societies and Civilizations. He is also president of the American Institute for Afghanistan Studies and is co-author of Afghanistan, An Atlas of Indigenous Domestic Architecture. And his latest book is Afghanistan, A Cultural and Political History. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Barfield.
Thank you.
And the elections that took place on Saturday in Afghanistan are being hailed by both Afghan and Western leaders as a success. I think there was about 20 people killed, and a number of Taliban were also killed. And the weather was very poor, but apparently there was a record turnout, I think more than twice that turned out in the last election, of course, that were heavily marred by a fairly brazen rigging. Is that your understanding?
Yes, there seemed to have been much more excitement on this. Of course, this is the first election that Afghanistan has ever had without an incumbent, and that whoever wins, it promises to change the administration. So it's bound to generate some excitement.
But we won't know the results probably for a while. And then if one of the three candidates doesn't make it to 50%, there will be a runoff in May, right?
Yes, because while there are three front runners, there are many more candidates, so the likelihood of anybody getting a majority in this round are pretty slim, so we can expect to see a runoff, I believe.
So, Thomas Barfield, you have Ashraf Ghani, who American-educated. He's from the Pashtun tribe. His running mate is Abdul Rashid Dostum, the leader of the Uzbek group. Ghani, of course, was the finance minister under Karzai. The other front-runner who ran last time is Dr. Abdullah, who's with the Tajiks, although I believe either his mother or father was a Pashtun. He is partnered with Mohammad Mohadek, who is a leader of the Hazara ethnic group near the Iranian border in that area. He also has a Pashtun on the ticket who's affiliated with a splinter group of the Taliban. And then you have Zalmay Rasool, who's pretty much the establishment candidate. He's a Karzai ally and former foreign minister as well, backed by the president's brother. From your reading of it, of the tea leaves, who do you think is going to come out ahead?
Well, I do think Abdullah will be in the runoff, and I think right now probably the fiercest fight is between Rasool, who was Karzai's sort of hand-picked nominee, although he refused to endorse anybody. Karzai forced his brother out of the race, and his brother threw his support to Rasool. That happened on a couple of other minor candidates that way. But it's also true that Karzai has, it may not be his first choice, but also has backed Ghani to some extent. The interesting thing here is that from the point of view of, with the exception of Abdullah, whose father is a Pashtun but is perceived to be allied with the Tajiks, all the other candidates running for president are sort of splitting the Pashtun votes. So it's a problem. How do you get to the second round? And actually having Dostum as his vice president is not helping him with his Pashtun constituencies, because Ghani has sort of run as a champion of the Pashtuns at some place, but taking on a warlord who's has a fairly tough record against the Pashtuns in the civil war has made his life a little bit difficult.
And the establishment candidate Rasul, his running mate is a woman, right? Habiba Sarabi.
Yes, that's a first for Afghanistan.
So and of course the Taliban largely come from the Pashtuns. So
yes, but so does the ruling dynasty. So they right. make up, if not a majority, a plurality of Afghans. So it's not surprising that they come in all sizes and flavors.
Well, Thomas Barfield, since you've been going to Afghanistan for many decades now and studying the culture and the politics, what can you explain this sort of the disconnect between the apparent disconnect between the obvious sense of aspirations for governance and democracy? There's a poll from the Free and Fair Election Foundation that found 75% of Afghans say they wanted this election. And it's pretty clear from the coverage that the Afghan people, you see them lined up in this lousy weather under the threat of attacks from the Taliban. So there's no question about the aspirations for democracy, but yet what we see in that government is anything but encouraging.
Well, that's true, and one of the reasons people are out is, I don't know whether they expect to see change, but I think they hope for it, in that Karzai's been in charge for 12 years, and one of the questions is, if you get a change of leadership in a country that depends so much on personal relationships, would some of these older corrupt structures be swept aside? The real difficulty, however, is while the Afghans have elections, they lack a lot of the apparatus that you really need for democracy, including political parties. So whether it's for parliament or district level or for the presidency, all these candidates run as individuals. It's really hard to change a system when everybody is being voted for as an individual and there's no party structure in Afghanistan. Candidates do not run as representatives of a party. This makes it very difficult to actually put together a government after you win.
Again, I'm speaking with Thomas Barfield, who's a professor of anthropology at Boston University, where he directs the Institute for the Study of Muslim Societies and Civilizations. He's also the president of the American Institute of Afghanistan Studies and co-author of Afghanistan, an Atlas of Indigenous Domestic Architecture. And his latest book is Afghanistan, A Cultural and Political History. So on Friday, two Associated Press journalists were shot in the Khos province, sitting in the back of a car. One, of course, is an award-winning German photographer, Anja Niedringhaus, and she died, and then a Canadian reporter, Kathy Gannon, was injured. That sort of leads one to sort of question this, you know, antediluvian kind of medieval component of Afghan society, that has it been changed by this 11 years of American occupation and the billions of dollars that have been poured in? I mean, this was an act of a soldier, supposedly, on our side.
Yes, this is a most unfortunate situation, because to some extent it seems to be almost random as opposed to a targeted attack. But I would say that the impact of the United States, the international community in general, has been largest in the cities. And the two reporters are visiting one of the most conservative rural areas in Afghanistan. And to some extent, it's almost like night and day sometimes between the rural and urban areas. And this has a very long-standing division in Afghanistan, that policies that are popular in the capital are often opposed by conservatives, and particularly along the Pakistan border in various rural areas. And that's one of the dichotomies of Afghanistan, that what it looks like often depends upon where you happen to stand.
So the assumption would be that this soldier just was offended by the presence of these Western women. because
he was apparently as a police officer, but one can only presume he did immediately surrender, so he's alive. So presumably there'll be a trial, and perhaps we'll find some reason. Actually, in terms of rural Afghanistan, this is extremely shocking because these people would be considered guests, and guests are not supposed to be subject to violence. They're under the protection of the local community, and also that they're women. In Afghanistan, women are not normally considered to be targets of like blood revenge or assassination or anything else. So it'll actually shock many rural Afghans, much as the Taliban attack on the Serena Hotel, in which an Afghan journalist and his family was shot dead, tended to shock Afghans, whether they were rural or urban, because it broke many of their own cultural values that structure even things like violence, and so are considered to be quite upsetting and out of the norm.
And he was a popular journalist, and of course his wife and children were killed with him, and that is considered crossing the line. And in the other case of the women being shot in this area near the Pakistan border, they were subject to what's called Pashtunwali, right? The code of...
In which case women are not considered to be legitimate targets of warfare. I mean, that's, you know, if you want to take their own point of view and their own types of values, there's a violation there. It's not considered an honorable act by any means, or an appropriate act of war or anything else.
But clearly, this country for the longest time has been a sort of rentier state, and it's not economically sustainable. And one of the great tragedies, at least to me, Thomas Barfield, is the enormous amount of money that was poured in, and with the expectation. A friend of mine who spent a lot of time there said that when the U.S. first moved in there and had that quick victory against the Taliban, the people were thrilled to see the Taliban go, and had this real expectation that America was the miracle worker. You know, what he had heard from various villagers was, well, the Americans have put a man on the moon. They can sure fix this place. Well, that didn't happen.
That's correct, is that if you actually look at the early years of the Bush administration, it pivoted towards Iraq, and actually it cut the development budget for Afghanistan when it went into Iraq. So Afghanistan was actually starved of resources at the beginning, and there was never any urgency about making things happen. Also, there was never really an attempt to think, well, how are you going to build Afghanistan if it's a largely agricultural economy? How do you at least start with getting that to work? So while a lot of money was spent, a lot of Afghans saw that not much really reached them. This produced a certain amount of cynicism over time, but also a tremendous amount of disappointment that a lot of money seemed to be pouring in, but to very little effect.
So, Thomas Barfield, could something have worked? I mean, when you've got a situation where the elite, including the President Karzai's own family, are sending billions, at least hundreds of millions of dollars, from very questionable, either from drugs or from USAID that's been pilfered, to Dubai, plane loads of it have been going out. So how can one have much confidence in a country when its own elite doesn't have any confidence in it?
Well, its own elite quickly realized that if you were sending money in without responsibility, why not take most of it? I think right at the beginning, before these huge amounts of money had come in, or essentially before corruption had become endemic, if you actually said, okay, we're going to build a road, and this is how much we're going to pay per mile, and we're not going to pay it till it's finished, and you get a road, you get $10,000, you know, per kilometer or something. There would have been ways to sort of work with Afghanistan to have not sort of paperwork responsibility, but actual responsibility. Are we getting value for money? And that never seemed to be a priority of the Bush administration, particularly. And as a result, a rather poor set of government officials came in and realized nobody's really keeping track of the money, and nobody's looking to see is the money actually being spent to do what it's said to being spent. And that's sort of a recipe for corruption and for cynicism. And the reports that have been coming out now about how poorly this money has been spent, if they had been coming out in 2003, 2004, and 2005, we might have been able to correct it. It's a little bit late now to say, look at all we've done, and it's either not there or not working.
Well, because the Pentagon can't even figure out its own bookkeeping about what happened to all this money in Afghanistan, you are led to assume that not only did Afghans pilfer the money, Afghan officials in particular, but it looks like Americans also pilfered the money.
Well, some of it's pilfering, but some of it is if you give a contract that has 50% in overhead, that's not considered a corruption. That's considered good accountancy. So a lot of the money that was spent in Afghanistan never reached Afghanistan. It was spent on consultants. It was spent on contracts. And, you know, to some extent, we don't consider that corruption, but many Afghans looking at it says, what's worse, you know, a contract that provides 80% overhead or a governor that steals 20%? As far as they're concerned, they want to see actually what happens on the ground. And if you actually check, money that was pledged was never delivered. Money that was delivered, each country, not just the United States, tended to want to spend it on its own people. If it was a Japanese project, you buy Toyotas. If it was an American project, you buy Chevys. There was really sort of an attempt to, you know, to see the money was spent almost to, you know, benefit the people providing the aid as opposed to the Afghans themselves.
So, Thomas Barfield, just in the last couple of minutes, we know, of course, Karzai has not signed the agreement that would ratify whatever deals that the U.S. and NATO have made in terms of what they're going to leave behind. The other candidates have said they would. But most of the speculation you hear says that there'll be some kind of resumption of a civil war, although one would think from the Pakistani side, since they have clearly been financing, sheltering, and directing, if not directing the Taliban, all the while stabbing America in the back, they apparently are having second thoughts about a Taliban government in Afghanistan, which could create a reverse sanctuary situation for the Pakistan Taliban, which, in other words, would give aid and comfort to the Pakistan Taliban and be even more of a threat to the state of Pakistan. So is that your understanding, that maybe the Pakistanis think they can somehow control the chaos, the post-American withdrawal chaos?
Well, the Pakistanis have sort of always believed that all the way back to the Soviet period. And they've usually been badly surprised that their Afghan clients tend to be not so cooperative exactly when you want them to be cooperative, that they made poor puppets and actually put Pakistan in danger. The Pakistanis told Mullah Omar to turn over Osama bin Laden. They said, if you don't turn him over, the Americans are coming, and that would be a disaster for you and for us. And Mullah Omar ignored them. That was probably the biggest policy error that Pakistan, you know, experienced, because it could not control the Taliban. The other difficulty is it's not really clear. This will be the fourth foreign withdrawal from Afghanistan. Insurgents are very good about getting rid of foreigners in their country because they have a home to go home to and they want to go home. But they found it actually very difficult to overthrow Kabul governments that retain the support of international backers. The Soviets pulled out and they gave Najibullah only 6 months. They certainly thought the Mujahideen would overthrow him. He outlasted the Soviet Union. It turns out that that insurgencies are good at some things but not at others, and certainly the Najibullah government was much more unpopular than this government is. That's one of the reasons that people are concerned about signing the agreement with the Americans, not the number of troops, but they know if there's no foreign troops in the country, there'll be no foreign money coming in. They can probably survive with few or no troops. They can't survive without outside aid. So there's a very strong concern there in terms of stability. And the Afghans worried that their last civil war resulted because no international power was interested in what went on in Afghanistan. And that's a very sore memory in Afghanistan about what happens if the international community decides to turn its back on the country.
Well, Thomas Barfield, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Thomas Barfield, who's a professor of anthropology at Boston University, where he directs the Institute for the Study of Muslim Societies and Civilizations. He's also president of the American Institute of Afghanistan Studies and the co-author of Afghanistan, an Atlas of Indigenous Domestic Architecture. And his latest book is Afghanistan, A Cultural and Political History. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back and get an assessment of the success of the Affordable Care Act sign-up of 7.1 million Americans.